them competitive. Today, I'm announcing a new plan to protect the integrity of our immigration system. Federal law prohibits the entry of communists and totalitarians into the United States. But my question is, what do we do with the ones that are already here that grew up in it? I think we have to pass a new law for them. Using federal law in Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act, I will order my government to deny entry to all communists and all Marxists. Those who come to and join our country must love our country. We want them to love our country. We don't want them when they want to destroy our country. Welcome to America. We want to destroy your country. Thank you very much. So we're going to keep foreign, Christian-hating communists, Marxists, and socialists out of America. We're keeping them out of America.
The MAGA communists, though, you can just come right to Mar-a-Lago. We got some great fun planned for y'all. Hey, y'all. Matt Leck here, David Griscom, episode 124 of Left Reckoning. How you doing, David?
I'm doing good, brother. Dark, dark day for the MAGA communist morons. To see the
Or is it a confirmation that actually everything has been going perfectly and we got Trump right where we want him? He needs to get to the bottom before we need to break him down before we can build him back up into this Napoleonic champion of communism that we all know that he really deep down essentially is. Folks, we got a good show. Speaking of those guys, I think probably busy taking down their Prigozhin merchandise. We have some interesting stuff happened in Russia recently that we're going to get to. But before we get to that and have Yasha Levine on, let's talk about it. That happened, and Rick Scott is trying to surf the same wave. Here he is. Let's just get a little taste of him.
Senator Rick Scott here. Let me give you a travel warning. If you're a socialist, communist, somebody that believes in big government, I would think twice. Think twice if you're thinking about taking a vacation or moving to Florida. We're the free state of Florida. We actually don't believe in socialism. We actually know people, and some people in our state lived under it, and we know people lived under socialism. It's not good. It's not good for anybody. So if you're thinking about it, if you think about coming to Florida and you're a socialist or communist, think twice. We like freedom, liberty, capitalism, things like that.
Yeah, now the thing is I don't know why they don't feel the need to take a second cut or prepare.
Yeah, I was about to say. Things.
But it doesn't really matter. Like, ultimately, that their lack of technical and production skill, this is pretty alarming. And I think I just can't help. I was on vacation when you talked about this, but the whole signing the anti-socialist bill that like Ro Khanna participated in, and even like Pramila Jayapal knew not to, but like a lot of like, was it Warren that also did it too? I should know specifically who did that, but like that stuff is actually worrying to me, despite how like ludicrous these figures seem.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a part of this that this is just, you know, good old American tradition. But remember that, you know, things can slide really quickly. I mean, looking, for example, at like opinion poll, and look at something that folks thought was settled, like gay marriage in this country. Look how quickly the right has been able to whip up their base in a frenzy about it. You know, I wouldn't sit too comfortable and think that, you know, there's no potential of there ever being a kind of backslide on, you know, civil and political rights for people. You know, remember that right now, to be a citizen of this country, there already is a section, for example, denying citizenship in the United States if you're a member of a communist party or a totalitarian party, as they describe it. And as Liza Featherstone wrote in Jacobin, you know, despite, you know, McCarthy and McCarthyism sort of being used as an insult for the most part in American politics, there are a lot of these laws that are still on the books. And recently, just last this month, you know, CPUSA members were refused a booth at the Oklahoma City Pride Festival because of a 1955 McCarthyite law declaring Communist Party membership illegal in the state. And, you know, there's been pretty significant Supreme Court rulings on this. But in this country, you know, there are still a lot of these old anti-communist laws that are on the books, anti-communist, anti-socialist, in states like New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Alabama, California, Washington, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Tennessee, and Virginia. Despite the Supreme Court's ruling against Washington's law, a 2012 legislative effort to repeal it failed. You know, so there's not only tradition of it, there's a lot of things that are just sort of sitting there that just have been unused for a prolonged period in American politics and history. So, like, look, I don't think it's worth getting breathless about this kind of stuff, obviously. But also, I don't think it's appropriate or correct to tell people to not be worried, for example, about this kind of increase in rhetoric, as funny as it is when Trump is trying to remember what code he's going to use.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's alarming in the sense that, like, there have been two sort of main narratives I remember in terms of political economy, which is that, oh yeah, don't intervene in that at all. The capitalists will deal with it, and the free market is the way. And now it's actually nobody really believes that. It's just like, how is the government going to intervene? Is it going to be in any kind of democratic fashion, or is it going to be for corporations?
Yeah.
And that you see this being developed is, I think, as a reaction, because that's the only way that that sort of ideology wins is repression, whether violent or, you know, other means. So, yeah.
And last thing, not that it needs to be said again, but those MAGA communism weirdos taking another big L when dear leader Mr. Trump says he's coming for them.
Yeah, love you guys. Love your YouTube streams. I watch them. I am a little bit like Lenin. All right, folks. Now I want to welcome to the show journalist Yasha Levine. Yasha is journalist at yasha.substack.com. Also co-host of the podcast, along with Evgenia Kovja of The Russians, and author of a book I can't recommend enough, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet, which is a topic that people have gotten really interested in lately, and I would recommend checking out Yasha's book. Yasha, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Just ignore my, I know it's summer, but I'm in San Francisco, so this is how you have to be outside at 4 p.m. you know, on a June afternoon.
Oh man, I'm jealous.
It's pretty nice actually. but yeah, no, I mean, I got like two layers of socks. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah, thank you for the introduction.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been catching up with the Russians. You and Evgenia did a recap on the year anniversary last February, and you just released the episode this afternoon on what we're talking about, or what sort of brought this up again, because Dave and I haven't gotten too deep into we're not experts in this conflict, we're not following the OPSEC stuff, but you know, something major happened last weekend with Prigozhin and an apparent sort of Bacon's rebellion style revolt against the structure, but not the king, because he wasn't really going against. What happened last week, Yasha?
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone really knows what actually happened. I mean, what's pretty clear is that when you, you know, do this kind of invasion and do this almost total mobilization of your society against, in a war, you know, against your neighbor, against essentially a kind of kindred culture and against the kindred people, and you pump the country full of, you know, wartime propaganda, and you activate the most reactionary, sort of nationalistic, patriotic elements in society. You give them weapons. You send them to the front. You promote these people. You make them into heroes. You also use shadowy groups that, like the Wagner Group that, you know, we're going to talk about now, that's headed by this guy named Yevgeny Prigozhin, and make them sort of central heroes in the narrative against, you know, in your fight against the West, against NATO, against liberal values, against Ukraine, against Nazis. Weird shit starts to happen. You know, weird shit can happen. And in Russian history, these kinds of things have happened before, in the past. And so no one really knows what happened. I mean, what we know is some facts, I guess, you know, some basic facts. We know that the head of this private and paramilitary organization called Wagner Group, this guy named Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's been a a rising sort of star, rising player in Russian, I don't know, dare I say, deep state politics, who's started out as a kind of a petty thief in the Soviet Union, went into business in the late 90s during the kind of perestroika and the loosening up of the economy, selling hot dogs in this outdoor market in the center of St. Petersburg, in the center of Leningrad, and then St. Petersburg, and kind of moved up into different business ventures, restaurants, casinos, ransom restaurants that famously Putin and George Bush, when he made a state visit to Russia in 2002 with his wife, Laura, actually ate at. And so there's pictures of Prigozhin kind of hanging out in the background behind Putin and George Bush and Laura Bush in 2002 on a floating restaurant that Prigozhin owned at the time. You know, weird stuff like that. And then he moved up and kind of started handling all sorts of shadowy things for the government. He had some kind of connection to Putin. He ran a catering company. It serviced various official functions, you know, provided catering. He then kind of in a very covert way launched this private paramilitary organization, Wagner Group, that was first involved in 2014 conflict in Ukraine and then was really heavily involved in the Syrian conflict. But all this time, Prigozhin denied that he was involved in it at all. And it was a very shadowy organization. Again, it was very visible. Mm-hmm. A lot of people covering the Syrian conflict, but like actual structure was never confirmed about who controlled it, you know, who was the guy behind the scenes. And only in 2002, after this war began, he said, no, I am the guy behind this organization. I am the guy behind Wagner Group, and started being a very, very public face of this organization. And it took a very visible role in this war in Ukraine since the invasion. And he's taken a very visible position in there, in that he's always, you know, he's always doing off the cuffs interviews, kind of being candid and kind of populist. And honest, you know, about sort of the mistakes and sort of the problems with official military structures that he sees it. And he's been feuding with the sort of the official Ministry of Defense structures that he is, I mean, and he's sort of subservient to them, right? He's sort of outside of them, but also subservient to them, because all the money that he has, all the equipment that he gets, all the ammo, all the heavy machinery that he uses and that his troops use, or his group uses in the front in the war, comes from the Ministry of Defense. But he's been having this increasing feud with the Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu, who is like a kind of a, you know, he's Putin's guy. He's been around for a long time, and he's constantly sort of, there's rumors that he might be the next appointed, you know, leader of Russia. Like he's kind of like, as if he's being groomed. I mean, there are all these rumors. It's not clear if you can believe them or not, but he's Putin's guy. And so Prigozhin has been very, very aggressively and kind of in an interesting way fighting this, essentially like a YouTube war, you know, against this guy, because he would just sit down and do these interviews, and he would just really lean into him. I mean, just like in a way that was, you don't do that unless you're either insane and have a death wish, or you have some kind of something behind you, standing behind you, or you think you have someone standing behind you. And so this escalated, and I think part of the conflict was that there's been attempts by the Minister of Defense to essentially disband the Wagner Group and kind of absorb it into official military structures. At least, again, these are sort of the rumors that have been swirling around. And so all of that conflict, you know, that Prigozhin had with Sergei Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, and sort of the official, sort of security state structures, came to a head where he claims his base, where the Wagner Group soldiers were stationed in Eastern Ukraine, got bombed by the military, you know, by the Russian military. So by his own guys, essentially. And that was like the final straw. He says, again, this is a sort of like, you have to take him at his word about it. That's what happened. And he's decided that he can't take it anymore. He's not going to let these guys kill his boys. And, you know, and in fact, like these guys that are, you know, Putin's, essentially like a security state elite are the problem why the war has been going badly. They're the reason why everything's fucked up. They're lying to Putin. They're stealing, you know, every chance they get. They're pocketing all this money. They're corrupt. They don't know what's going on. They don't really care about Russia. They don't care about a great Russia. We're losing because of them. And I'm going to like do this march on on Russia to make sure that people know, like to make people know that this is an issue and that it needs to be rectified. And it's he kind of gave this 30-minute speech. It was pretty interesting. It was very populist. He talked a lot about how, you know, the entire security apparatus, including the KGB, including the Ministry of Defense, is very corrupt, uses every possible way to enrich themselves and doesn't really care about winning the war. And although he never criticized Putin directly, he never really praised him either, which I found to be very strange. Like, if this is a guy just saying, you know, there's this whole, in Russia, there's this thing, it's like the Tsar is always blameless. It's always the boyars that are the problem, right? And if only the Tsar knew what was going on, because the Tsar is always, like, you know, good and perfect and blameless, like, then he would step in and rectify the situation. If that's kind of what he was doing, and on one level that is what he was doing from the rhetoric, but he didn't praise Putin enough, you know, like he didn't like say like Putin was doing an amazing job. He has the best, you know, the best interest of the people in it, but it's just his it's the people who he's appointed to wage this war. They're fucked up, but Putin's great. He never really said that. And so it was a very strange thing. And so he did that. He marched on Rostov. He very easily captured or took control of the local. Rostov is a pretty big city down in southern Russia, just across the border from eastern Ukraine. And so he took control of the sort of the provincial military headquarters there. I don't think, from what I understand, there aren't a lot of troops stationed there. It's more like, you know, more like an office building. And so, but he still took control of it, was able to get some of the top leadership guys there and basically have them sit down with him. And he's fully equipped with a machine gun. They're disarmed, you know, they're just sitting there kind of in their slippers, looking kind of skittish a little bit, you know. And so he took control of that, and he said he was going to march on Moscow and send his guys to Moscow to kind of take it. It's not clear what he wanted to do, but he wanted, you know, I guess Shoigu to step down, or he wanted him turned over to the Wagner group so they could like deal with him, you know. And so he never really made it to Moscow. Lukashenko, as it turns out, was in the middle of negotiating with him and convinced him to turn around, because he said that Putin had made the decision to exterminate Prigozhin and exterminate this column of Wagner soldiers that were making their way to Moscow. And Lukashenko said he talked Putin down and said that, look, well, you can just come to Belarus, kind of hang out here for a while, and, you know, and sort of fix the situation. And then Prigozhin, after he aborted this, I don't know what you call it, like a mutiny or whatever it was, he aborted it, and I don't know if he was already in Belarus or if he was one of his stations, one of his bases in eastern Ukraine, but he gave this spiel about how essentially this wasn't a coup, this wasn't a mutiny, this was like a march for justice. He was like a march for justice for the Russian people. And basically that's what happened. I mean, that's just the sort of the facts of the case about what the you know, there's so much speculation. I mean, this is one of these events where, like, I don't know, just the full on ridiculousness of sort of the Russia expert, you know, community. And like, and now it's gotten even more ridiculous with just, you know, I don't know, social media is like, everyone is a fucking expert. Yeah. Everyone.
Yeah.
Yet almost none of these people even can like read Russian or speak Russian and know very little about Russia itself. They just sort of, so yeah, it just breaks down into camps, and people like talk about what they want to believe or what they want to happen. So you have like on the sort of the American liberal kind of neocon side, Democratic Party, you have them cheering, you know, Prigozhin's attempted coup because they think that it'll destabilize Putin and that anybody other than Putin is great because they'll be weaker than Putin. But it's like, wait, so you want just some random thug that you don't even know much about to take control of the Russian state and potentially control of its military and its nuclear arsenal just because it'll make it weaker. So you just have like that kind of extremist almost position, totally insane. Also very, very, you know, delusional, because it was clear that whatever the larger forces that are around this conflict, and no one really knows what's actually going on. It's clear that this probably wasn't going to happen, you know? So there's the fantasies on that side, you know, going down to the sort of these kind of strange, I don't know, like these kind of weird people imperialist kind of leftists who think that Putin is fighting a war for the global South, you know? And that he's actually, you know, like fighting for justice, you know, geopolitical justice or something, you know, like thinking and also believing that Putin is infallible and Putin is actually smarter than anyone else in the room or anyone else in the world. And so this can't be that Putin this can't show that Putin's weak or that there's like fractures within his government, within his state, among different clans, that this is like Putin's way of playing this 5D chess of, you know, I don't know, like purging weak elements from, you know, his government in this sneaky fashion. So you have like this whole, like, you know, very big wide spectrum of fantasies and analyses, you know, of what's actually going on. And so,
Yeah.
I mean, the some of the breathless stuff that was coming out, you know, when this event started were truly amazing. I mean, you know, I was seeing people like very confidently saying that he had sort of captured maybe even potentially like nuclear weapons and things like that, right? Which is just like, you know, the confidence and the bravado, which a lot of people start talking about Russia, is something that truly
like brainless regime change. Like they've just decided like we want a brainless regime change, even though we don't want to say that's actually what one of our interests is.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, people are pretty clear about, you know, to decolonize Russia. I mean, it's kind of a meme now at this point, you know, like you just want to cut, you know, Russia into like, you know, 100 different municipalities and principalities.
That will work out really
well. And have them whatever, you know. And so, I mean, but yeah, it's just, it's interesting because, you know, Prigozhin actually, what he says, what he said in his like initial address that kind of launched that he did this kind of manifesto almost like online, you know, on YouTube, and then like posted it and just like waited a day and then like marched, you know, like to see what would happen. No one you know appeased him, so he like marched on Moscow, you know. When he made that speech, I mean, a lot of it, he's arguing from almost a more nationalistic perspective. I don't know if he's more nationalistic than Putin, but he's much more, I guess, the kind of he's not tongue-tied about it, you know. He's a lot more open about it, but he's arguing from a like ultra patriotic position, which is that you know, the ruling elite of this country is incompetent. They care about just plundering, you know, and using the budget and to enrich themselves with the budget. We're here, the patriots, the fighters, dying, you know, we're being killed, we're dying because of their mistakes, you know. And so, and sort of, and so, and also saying that, like, I mean, this is probably one of the more interesting aspects of what he said. He said that, like, the war, the invasion of, you know, of Kiev, or attempted invasion of Kiev in February 2020, what's 2020, right? I can't even remember what year we're in anymore. Wasn't necessary. That he said that there was no threat coming from the Ukrainian side. There wasn't like a buildup of forces. You know, Ukraine wasn't like in a position to imminently attack Russia. There was nothing out of the ordinary. You know, he says that the war was launched essentially for the benefit of this ruling security elite and for them to like bask in the glory of a good war that they fucked up. I mean, there's some truth I think about it. I mean, I don't know if they actually, you know, they wanted just the glory, but I think his point about that there was no threat to Russia at that moment, and that they were lying to the Russian people about Ukraine being sort of ready to launch this invasion of Russia and that it needed to be stopped. He calls them out on this lie. You know, I mean, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty direct. It's, I mean, he's got a lot of people who, I don't know, he's that message reached millions and millions of Russian people. I mean, and a lot of people in sort of this Russian kind of war commentariat that's sort of Russian war bloggers or Russian war influencers that sort of popped up after this war. I mean, they really were in love with Wagner before this thing, but they quickly turned on him because they ultimately sided with the regime and with Putin's government and thought that he was sowing, you know, instability. But I think generally his appeals to this sort of right populist appeals to the people, you know, because he's,
because didn't he say things that were sort of like, you know, almost like Debsian, right? Like, you know, Eugene Debs says like the war the rich declare wars, like the poor fight them. He was saying things like of that nature too. So ironic, because remember, folks, that like this is like a very powerful and well off guy.
He's a billionaire. Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's funny because I think the bulk of his money came from lucrative contracts to feed the Russian troops. So he's a food contractor, the Ministry of Defense. Like his catering company provides foods to military bases and to barracks and things like that. and to Russian schools around the country. So he is this like he was made a billionaire by his access and connections to the military and industrial complex or to the state, you know. So it's interesting for him to go against those very structures, you know, which is kind of confusing and maybe hints at something kind of a deeper play of some kind. I know that like some people who are on his side, I mean, look, these are just all rumors swirling around sort of Russian Telegram channels, mm-hmm. various people with various levels of access or, you know, various levels of insight. But a lot of people think that this was not just like him acting, you know, by himself, that he was a kind of a front man for some interests, you know, within the Russian deep state that were testing the waters for a coup. I mean, these are what people, mm-hmm. Some people think happened. Again, yeah. We don't fucking know. We don't know anything. And anyone who tells you they know is lying, you know. So it is what it is. But it's clearly, I mean, just from my own analysis of this, you know, whatever the superficial analysis that I can make is that I don't think it's very good for the Russian state and for Russia, for Putin's rule, because it does show him being kind of weak, you know, and that the fact that something like that could happen, and also him being kind of soft about it. He doesn't come out and just be like, okay, we're gonna slaughter you, like, mm-hmm. this is, you do this, you're dead, like your families are dead, I don't know, you're like, you know, your grandparents are dead, you know, that kind of stuff. Or he was very soft about it. He at first he declared them, you know, traitors who are betraying their country and are aiding the enemy. But after this deal with Lukashenko was made and Wagner kind of disbanded and returned back to their bases and agreed essentially to be partially disbanded and partially integrated into the Russian Ministry of Defense. Putin, you know, like went and called Wagner soldiers heroes, Wagner soldier commanders who were fighting for Russia in Ukraine and were dying for Russia in Ukraine and making sacrifices for Russia in Ukraine. So he was praising them, you know, at the same time saying that some of them, you know, made a mistake. They made a terrible mistake. They were led astray, but they're, you know, but they're patriots and they're great, good people. It's a very, I don't know if this is like just his strategy of like praising them, diffusing the situation, and then later kind of whacking everybody when the state pulls down. But regardless, I mean, him having to come on and make these addresses on TV, you know, on consecutive days, he rarely does that. You know, he rarely shows up on TV to do these kinds of things. So it does make him clearly that he's shaken by it. It's, I don't know what, I don't know if this makes him stronger. Definitely makes him not stronger, I think, you know.
Yeah, the nature of the critique just seems kind of worrisome if I was doing a war. Like, you're calling my general a pussy and saying that he misled me into this. Like, yeah. And then I'm just supposed to
do anything about it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And and then, so, you know, you talk about the populism and you know, and what's your sense of, like, and to the sense you can have gathered it, morale, whether it's the Russian people or the folks who are, like, Wagner, I take it, like, or I understand, has taken, like, folks out of prisons and put them on the front lines and used that for a type of war. Like, that sort of discussion of this is all pointless, like, that's not something you want out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's exactly. I mean, well, first of all, I don't know. From like a point of view, if you're running a state and you have, you know, a big carceral state with a prison, pretty large prison population, a violent prison population, I mean, and you're waging a war, it's not a bad idea to send your comics out there, because they're going to get, you know, especially you send them out there, most of them get killed. Some of them don't, and they return, and they're not free, and they're out and about, even more traumatized and scary and crazy. And there have been instances of already of, like, you know, these sort of ex-cons who've gotten out for murder or rape and, you know, have served their time on the front and are, like, out in cities and are getting, again, like, in pretty violent situations. So that's going to happen. I mean, what's happening with this war is it's creating a hardened veteran, very nationalistic, ultra-patriotic class of people. If this war ever ends, they're going to, you know, enter society, they're going to enter politics, they're going to become, you know, figures in society, they're going to influence society in some kind of way. And So, I mean, I think this whole war is just going to lurch the entire country, most likely to in that direction, just because there's no countervailing ideology in Russia. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about, you know, what I think, because I didn't predict this war. In fact, I believe that, you know, it was going to happen, just because my whole understanding of Putin and his ruling elite was that they kind of made a deal with, like, it's all about, you know, consumer capitalism, essentially, and a kind of the promise of slightly increasing standard of living for the population, and, you know, access to a kind of a consumerist lifestyle, and essentially a stability, you know, offering the Russian people stability in their lives, something that they've lacked, something that the generation that was kind of is alive now has lacked. And so, and this is why he's been insanely popular domestically. It's why people will support him even if they don't like him, because he's delivered. You know, he's delivered on a kind of a more or less prosperous society. Russia is poor, is a very poor country. It's actually a very rich country, but its riches are extremely unfairly distributed. And so people kind of are okay with this oligarchy that owns everything, that controls everything, and that has this very rapacious lifestyle, as long as some of that trickles down to the rest of the people. And there's clear growth and standard of living and things like that. And so with this war, you know, he put all that at risk. Mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, he's not so wrong in launching this war, because what's happened is that kind of lifestyle, you know, just capitalism is not necessarily enough to give people meaning in their lives. You know, as we know from our experience in America, from life here in America, people need something else, a deeper connection to something. Mm-hmm. And nationalism, patriotism is, you know, is a very effective, deeper ideology that kind of transcends all that. And so, you know, he sort of like lurched Russia in a way into a more patriotic mode, into a more nationalistic mode, which and ultimately, you know, might strengthen his rule, you know, or the rule of his ruling elite, you know, whatever comes after him.
Well,
but him.
No, I mean, I just wanted to ask you on that, because I mean, like, you know, what this does to people's ideology and maybe, you know, the longevity potentially of the state is one thing. But like, I mean, this is, you know, a massive embarrassment for Putin, yeah, and the ruling institutions there. You know, in the U.S., there's like this kind of like two competing narratives about Russia. You know, one that, like, you know, Russia is basically in terminal decline in the sense of like how powerful its state is. And then at the same time, it's like Russia is like this extremely powerful authoritarian state. I mean, could you, you know, I don't want to make you speculate too much about like what this does, but you could give people like an understanding, like, you know, how much, you know, power does the state have, you know, contemporarily in people's lives? Because like something like this makes it seem like the state apparatus is fairly weak if you're having, you know, a march like this.
I mean, well, I don't know. It's a good question, because there's different aspects of the state, right? So, I mean, just let's say on the economic front, because everybody was expecting, you know, Russia's economy to completely collapse, right? After mm-hmm. after the sanctions, after these really mm-hmm. hardcore sanctions, probably, you know, and most people in Russia believed that the economy was going to collapse. Like, I have a couple of good friends who live in St. Petersburg who run these little businesses and stuff, and they were like, oh shit, we are fucked. You know, like, what are we going to do? I have my whole family's here. I don't have money to, you know, run to like Europe somewhere. I'm here. And they were like expecting the worst to happen. And I just actually spoke to my friend a couple of days ago, right after this Wagner group, you know, march on Moscow happened. And, you know, he was saying, yeah, like the economy is just, everything's great. Everything's going well. Like there's business, there's money, there's customers, there's like, you know, there's credit available. Like it's a vibrant economy. Like things are not going out, at least in most sectors that he's aware of. And so unlike the economic front, it seems like Russia is actually managing things very well, like the internal domestic economy. The central bank has managed this crisis, you know, from Russia's perspective, I think very well. Now, I think the economy at the same time, you know, there are, I think, you know, there's so they've managed it much better than people expect mm-hmm. to manage it. And so I think to say that the state is just crumbling, I don't think that's true. I think over the last 10 years, you know, a lot of Russia, I mean, everything in Russia essentially starts in Moscow and kind of spreads outward, because that's where the center, that's where all the money is, that's where all the power is. And so, I don't know, if you go to Moscow, you'd be surprised how extremely effective it is. I mean, it's more effective. It's extremely efficient. Like, I mean, all the, like, it's all modern. All the city is extremely clean. The city is extremely well managed in terms of, like, if snow falls on the ground, it's cleaned immediately. The bus system has been expanded. There's, you know, they're adding capacity in the subway system in an insane way, almost like on a kind of, almost like on a China level. Just adding new stations, new entire, like, rings around the city, you know. Mm-hmm. All the subways are very clean, you know, well functioning. There's, like, Wi-Fi. I don't know. All the buses have Wi-Fi. You can, like, track everything on a smartphone. It's, like, it's all connected, you know. So it's actually the city is run really well. Like, there's, you know, and part of it is the one of the reasons is because Putin has these kind of several, you know, groups of very efficient sort of neoliberal managers. The mayor of Moscow, Sobyanin, he's an extremely efficient manager, you know, and he's, like, turned Moscow into this almost like, yeah, like a extremely well-functioned European city. Again, Moscow has a lot of money, but that stuff is expanding to also to St. Petersburg. So I think it would be unfit. I think it would be, it's not right to think that Russia is just, like, you know, a country that's on the verge of collapsing and its state institutions are completely very weak. I'd say that its army was shown to be probably, you know, weaker than expected. Its intelligence clearly was shown to be, you know, subpar in terms of the belief that they could just take Kiev and just, like, just march and waltz into Kiev with no backup plan and just take it and everything would be okay. But at the same time, you know, Russia isn't losing, you know, it's not winning, but it's like, you know, the West is pouring a lot of resources into Ukraine, you know, and Russia is holding its ground. It's okay. So it's not like has lightning victories, but at the same time, it's not crumbling. It's not like you don't see huge protests of people outside, you know, or, you know, it's not having trouble really finding, you know, people to sign up for the war. At least for now, you know, it's like finding enough capacity. Okay, fine. It's going to, like, the prison population and all that stuff. But again, it's waging the war. So I don't know. It's tricky to say. I think it's hard to say, but I think it's wrong to say that Russia is sort of institutionally very weak. But at the same time, you know, just to finish my thought here, my extended thought, I mean, there is a kind of a problem with Russia, which I think because it's such a personal government in terms of everything's kind of built on these personal relationships from the top going down, that if these personal relationships start to break apart or there's a kind of a warfare within that structure, it could in theory break down very quickly. But again, I don't know, you know, there's probably, like, several different theories of, you know, of political science theories about how these things work. And so far, most of the predictions of political scientists have been wrong in relation to Russia. And so I think Russia is not collapsing. It's not going to collapse tomorrow. It's not going to collapse next year. It probably won't ever collapse, you know, in the way that we think it will. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you in that year anniversary podcast with Evgenia, you talked about the change in affect with Putin. He was much more nervous and seems to be growing more confident. You know, I want to talk about now, like, kind of what this says about us and how we've reacted to this. Like,
wait, sorry, man. Sorry, man. Yeah, not to cut you off, but just, like, before we jump there, if that's okay. Yeah. So for Wagner Group, I mean, that's done, right? What's the future that looks? Sorry, Matt.
Go ahead.
I think it's done. From what I understand, the deal with Lukashenko essentially dissolved the Wagner Group, and I think the again, I don't know how accurate this is, but those Wagner soldiers who took part in this sort of march on Moscow, you know, this freedom riot, you know, the freedom riders, they might be chilling in Belarus, you know. I don't know what they're going to be doing there. Hopefully, you know, they're not going to send them to, maybe they'll be sent to a special camp, you know, where they're going to relax and never come back from there from it again. But the ones that didn't take part in the coup, I think, are just going to be absorbed into the official Ministry of Defense formations. That's what I understand, at least as far as, you know, as of yesterday evening, but who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Wagner is probably no more. Yeah. And I imagine that, you know, Putin will take a hard look at kind of at other, these private military corporations or, you know, these paramilitary groups, and maybe rein them in a bigger way. It's funny too, because I mean, in Ukraine, you could see a similar thing happen in Ukraine. You know, during when 2014, after Maidan, there were all of these private military organizations funded by various oligarchs. Mm-hmm. And they were essentially functioning outside of official military control, and were private armies. And ultimately, most of them were either disbanded or were absorbed into official ministry, you know, official military structures. Yeah, you know what's funny too, man. It is. I have to just mention it, just because I think it just gives you a sense of how absurd, I don't know, post-Soviet politics and post-Soviet culture is, you know, in that whole space, and how like identity and all these things. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much it matters. I mean, so Ukraine, right, has a Jewish president, Zelensky, and you know, it's like. Ukraine, you know, it's Ukraine ever since 2014 has had a very big nationalistic turn in its culture. You know, just a lot of the cultural signifiers, a lot of slogans that were essentially associated with the very, very, very far right of Ukraine, groups that had been, you know, had collaborated with the Nazis and were fascists, you know, like real fascists, that came up during between World War One and World War Two. You know, they've become kind of mainstream, and it's totally normal for a Jewish president to say their slogans, you know. Mm-hmm. And so Prigozhin is also Jewish, you know, and so you know, he's like head of this Wagner group, you know, is again a German composer, you know, he's got, you know, a favorite of a certain set of, you know, of people in Germany, and you know, one of his top lieutenants is like this guy who I mean I don't know, like, if reports about him are to be believed, he's got like giant swastikas on his fucking body, you know, like, mm-hmm. and his boss is a Jew, you know? And so it's like, and I don't know if actually Prigozhin even identifies as Jewish, because it doesn't really, you know, again, in the Soviet Union, like, just because you're Jewish or half Jewish or whatever, didn't mean that you really, it didn't really matter to you potentially. And, you know, and so Prigozhin is fighting this kind of nationalistic Russian war against its, you know, nationalistic neighbor, it's a comedy, you know, it's comic, and it's just shows you how mixed up everything is. And like, it's hard to, I don't know, man, it's like hard to, just hard to paint things in black and white.
This is why, Yasha, this is why I, you know, appreciate your perspective, because I think like it's pretty unseemly to see people treat this as an opportunity for partisan enthusiasm as opposed to like just depressing. And, you know, we don't talk about that much, because if I call it an unjust invasion, I get people calling me a NATO shill. And if I say like I want to look into like, yeah, that what we've been doing to antagonize sorts of things, or including like understand this as a proxy war where major powers are getting comfortable with. Can you just talk about how you approach that?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it has to be complex. I actually, it's a complex thing. I mean, I think this is essentially there is truth, and it's undeniable that like the American political or security elite, because I don't know if the business elite is even on board with this, you know, to be honest. Just like in Europe, it's very strange, you know. But again, the sort of national security elite of the country does see Ukraine as a kind of proxy for its war on Russia, and almost like a wedge or a crowbar or something you can kind of like pry Russia open and spill out its guts, you know, and keep it weak. This is just a reality. I mean, the people say this quite openly. You know, the political class in America says this quite openly. And there's a whole long history, you know, of America essentially disregarding any kind of concerns of sort of post-Soviet Russia, starting from Yeltsin, you know, through Putin about the expansion of NATO, and sort of aggressive moves on the part of NATO and America. And completely just disregarding, you know, like treating Russia as like just some kind of peasant that you can just sort of kick around, and like it's and that you lost the war, you know, you lost the Cold War, just shut the fuck up, get in the proper place in the pecking order, you know. And there's just truth to that, and the fact that, you know, and I've written a lot about this before the war, but you know, there's the other side of it too, which is, I mean, I have because I'm Russian, and you know, and I grew up in America, and you know, my half of my family is Russian. My wife's born and raised in Moscow. You know, we have like this slightly more complicated perspective on it. So if you're American, you know, you don't really see the Russian side of it at all. It's like, for you, it's like just very vague about, you just see everything through America's perspective. And so, but we see also from the Russian perspective, and the Russian perspective, you know, this was a dumb, unprovoked war in a way. I mean, it was provoked, but the response that Putin decided to go on, you know, was a really disastrous, a really bad one, you know, and it was probably the worst way of dealing with this from my perspective, obviously, because what it does is it changes Russian society in a major way. What it did is it's made the country a lot more, a lot more authoritarian. I mean, it's just, it's a reality. It's bolstered the most reactionary, nationalistic, toxic elements of society. It made dissent in any kind of way, like, just, I mean, you know, untenable. People don't do it, you know, in private they do it. You know, some people are, you know, post stuff on Facebook still, but you know, probably almost no one does. A lot of people that I know who are in academia, who are sort of, who are on in this very, very small left wing kind of movement in Russia, most all in the left country, because they know that if they, like, not only can't you criticize the war now, but retroactively things can be found against you, you know? So most of those people left. So it's actually emptied the country out of a lot of some of the more sort of interesting opposition to the regime. And it's made the country a lot more just intolerant and a worse place to live. I don't think people understand that, you know, like, I know that in America, you know, there's like, what's the closest sort of comparison? Probably most recent would be like the Iraq War, but yeah. Okay. Iraq War protesters were, arrested, and I participated in the Iraq War protest in 2003, and a bunch of my friends, you know, changed themselves together and blocked traffic and got arrested. But you could, you know, run a pretty successful blog where you can criticize the war and no one was, you know, knocking down your house and dragging you into jail. So it created a Russia, just in terms of just culturally, it sort of denuded it in terms of just the kind of culture, and left in its place a nationalistic, xenophobic kind of, you know, concentrated those elements of society. And so it made Russia worse from my perspective and from the perspective of people that I know and respect, you know. So whether or not, you know, it's like, you know, I sometimes ask this question, if it's like, let's say the left or something in America, would they, if let's say it was discovered that, you know, China put you know, a base of some kind, like it's done now, you know, like the news came out that China put a spy base in, it has a spy base or some kind of spy base in Cuba. Would everyone agree that's on the left, you know, in America, you know, the 5 or 10 people that are on the left in this country, would they agree that America is justified to go on and like bomb Cuba and wipe it off the face of this earth? I mean, so that's a justified invasion just because, sure, you know, a rival power puts, you know, is threatening you on your border. Of course they wouldn't, right? They would like condemn. They would condemn it as they condemned it in the past, right? And so I think, you know, it's that case. I think with the problem with a lot of Americans' perspective, you know, is that it's in a way it's very provincial, in the sense that they can't see beyond their own little world, and everything is about America and American politics and domestic politics. And so, you know, that's why you have these sort of Republicans suddenly becoming anti-war on just this Ukraine issue, because they see it can be sold as a Biden war, right? Meanwhile, they're hawkish on every other war, you know, that America, you know.
No, I mean, that's like the case with a lot of the right wingers. It's like, we're just not prosecuting war well, right? We have the wrong enemy.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, if this was someone else. Exactly. And so I think that, you know, it's been a disaster for the country, you know. I mean, not in the sense that it's collapsed economically, but just, I think, culturally, you know, and it's kind of a problem with Russia. If you analyze Russian history, you know, and Soviet history, it's been a problem, you know, and there's part of this country where like the kind of the most interesting people, you know, that are always like purged out of society, you know, and that happened in the Soviet Union. you know, very quickly after the revolution, there were huge purges, and basically anyone with any kind of fucking brain and any kind of interesting idea got fucking whacked or just got driven out of the country. You know, it's just the reality. And it's sort of what's happening now as well. I mean, you know, most of the people who are fleeing are, of course, I don't know, like liberal Russians who are pretty reactionary themselves in a different way. They're basically like libertarians and socially conservative, a lot of them, and kind of would be considered to be like Fox News Republicans, you know, in America, you know, but they're opposed to Putin for cultural reasons. You know, a lot of them have fled, you know, if they could get out and get a job in America or could sort of transfer to some kind of job in America, like in the tech sector or something, you know, or you know, there's been a lot of movement like that, but also it expelled a lot of people who are pretty interesting. And if there was a future in that country, you know, like, I mean, there's basically not a left left in Russia. I mean, it was tiny to begin with. And whatever like left energy that existed got siphoned into the nationalist world. So, you know, like, yeah, like, so it's really, I don't know, like as someone who's sees nationalism as a kind of a, is almost like a modern curse, you know, because it's an ideology that has such staying power and kind of transcends, can coexist very, very easily with various economic systems, and seems so natural to us if, at this point. You know, it seems like nationalism is almost like, I don't know, it's organic. It's not like to make a country even more nationalistic is a major problem for me, you know. And so I think, yeah, it's, so I kind of, I can see, you have to look at this war from different sides, you know, and yeah, just like, there isn't like a good guy essentially.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Yasha, I appreciate it. We'll have to have you back on. I want to talk Surveillance Valley and some of your Russian reporting. Folks, at Yasha Levine, we'll link to the Substack. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you.
You know, that reminds me of a talk I had with Michael about brutalization? And, you know, that word, our sort of Duke Nukem generation thinks of it as just like, oh, you're just shooting a rocket launcher. But it's actually a process through which people become more and more coarse. And like, that's something I try to keep it like. You can't make like Steven Crowder more coarse. So like you go at it, but like there's a certain type of thing. And this war is exactly that. Like our war has fucked us up too. Like war is not actually typically, I mean, I guess there's 1917, but Putin himself is like, you know, not like basically beyond, he calls himself Nicholas II, I believe.
Yes, he does, like which that. Is very amazing. And if you remember when he like made his justification for the war in Ukraine, like a lot of it was this long condemnation of Lenin.
Right. Even this most recent thing, I think he was he's like condemning Lenin. So yeah, it's depressing. I really recommend the Russians podcast, but go ahead, David.
No, it's super good. And like, I mean, I think we should just have Yasha on and talk about this later, because on another note, you know, it's connected, but even before the invasion, like, you know, I'll never forget one moment that, like, I don't know, just like, I think it's really important not to get yourself like spooked all the time, right? Just like what we were talking about earlier with like the socialists and the communists not being welcome in the US, blah blah blah. You know, understand what it is, so don't start freaking out yet, but also know that things can move really fast. And like a really visceral moment for me, I remember when I was still living in New York, is during the World Cup in Russia. And you know, for people who don't follow soccer, not gonna get into it, but like Russia was like the underdog team, right? Not like a great, at least in recent history, like soccer power, you know. And they had like a decent run, and usually, you know, when the home country has like a decent run, you know, fair weather fans jump on and cheer for them. I was at a bar in Park Slope, and for people who don't know New York, like, you know, that's like the very wealthy kind of liberal, a lot of pride flags, a lot of Ukraine flags now. And I was at a bar there, and there was this Russian woman who was sitting there watching the game camera who they were playing. You know, she was cheering for Russia at the World Cup, which is like one of the most fun things in New York, is that like you actually have people from those countries like watching at the bar with you. And the entire crowd started harassing this woman in like a really awful, horrific way. And it, you know, like you know, that's always like there's always that underbelly in American society, I guess. But just seeing that bubble up, particularly with a group of people who I generally, you know, would suspect would consider themselves to be like progressives or something like that, right? It's frightening to see those kind of like nationalisms and like national prejudices. You know, this is your neighbor, right? You know, it's frightening to realize that those kind of things like still exist, you know, not to be naive about them, but like, yeah, you know.
History's actually real. There's actually the real world happening out there. And yeah, the sort of victory of capitalism that we were birthed into was, again, read Jakarta Method, by Vincent Bevins. I mean, our own sort of COINTEL history domestically, it doesn't just win on its own. Mm-hmm. Right. And so these sorts of things, like, they become necessary. And so to like, and I like, even I think some of the like, I like, whatever the intention, if it's just to avoid an attack ad, the next thing, that does not cut it. Like, you cannot F around with stuff like that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it was great having Yash on. Maybe we should definitely try to do it again soon and look at some of these things. Before we go to the post game, folks, and you can join us at patreon.com/leftreckoning to hang out with us. We've got some fun stuff coming. We'll be taking calls and questions as well. Two quick things. One, for people in Austin, if you haven't seen or haven't been aware, and I believe also in Kansas as well, nurses who won a union and have been negotiating a contract here went on strike today and to try to force Ascension to the bargaining table. You know, these nurses, like many nurses across the country, face brutal working conditions, 14-hour shifts, they're underpaid, and they need more. And you know, this mobilization of nurses, I think, is something that's very, very exciting, and you should definitely be supporting them. And shout out to them. Just play a quick 10-second video here from this morning. This is from Gus Bova, former Left Reckoning guest. Hopefully we'll have him on again soon. And Greg Kassar, also a left progressive congressman from the area, speaking.
This with Texas nurses! This strike is an act of solidarity.
And there's much more there, you know, so solidarity to them. It's really important and exciting. There's tremendous amounts of community support, and Ascension should jump on the bargaining table. I mean, it's ridiculous. This is a critical service for people, has a lot of public support too. You don't want to be on the other side of that if you're Ascension.
And it's alarming that nurses, I kind of get that the attack on teachers is so harsh because, you know, it's thought control, mind control. This effort to go at teachers, bro, you use hospital beds too. I don't care if you don't want to hear about, you know, Thomas Jefferson's slaves. Like, you want nurses that are able to take fucking breaks. And the people that lead these hospital companies are actual psychos. Like, we make movies, genres out of different kinds of monsters, vampires, Draculas, werewolves. These people kill way more than any of those monsters do, right? Signing documents saying, actually, you know what? We don't need those beds. Actually, you know what? Don't need those nurses. That's way scarier than one guy with one knife, you know, and a scream mask, you know, chasing after one person.
No, totally. That's threatening your mom and your grandma, you know, your entire family.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, we'll keep our eye on that and keep covering, but want to do a quick shout out. But before we go to the post game, Matt, this is going to feature Greg Kassar again. But this is just so good. All right. Our illustrious governor. And also, if you didn't read my article in Jacobin, please do. I wrote a piece with Alex Brunel about HB 2127. We had him on the show last week to talk about it in depth, you know, which is one of the nastiest and most frightening anti-democratic bills that has been passed in a long while. Add to that the just blatant war on queer and trans people in the state of Texas and across many states across the U.S. You know, these are times where it's really important to be able to be out there and show solidarity with your friends and neighbors. But for fun, we have to look at this because this is pretty impressive. So Greg Kassar tweeted out, and he retweeted Greg Abbott, who deleted this tweet. Governor Abbott just accidentally posted a satire article because he wants to hate on queer Texans and Garth Brooks so bad. For people who don't know Garth Brooks, well, you should know who Garth Brooks is. I mean, he's one of the most famous artists, best-selling. He's up there with the Beatles, and Michael Jackson is one of the greatest selling artists of all time. You know, he has always sort of been one of these people who usually shows up on the right side, right? Maybe not like a radical revolution or anything like that, but you know, on social issues, like, you know,
yeah, it's Chris Gaines who is the Marxist.
Yeah, Chris Gaines is the Marxist and the sex addict, which also Chris Gaines might be coming back, but that's not the focus of the segment. You know, so Abbott tweets, anyways, Garth Brooks has basically not jumped on the trend on, you know, attacking queer and trans folks, and is that in fact affirmed them. And of course the right wing has been having a breakdown about it. Yeah, my governor, tweeted this out. Garth Brooks booed off stage at 123rd annual Texas County Country Jamboree. Go woke, go broke. Garth called his conservative fans assholes. Good job, Texas. And if you are listening to this later, the name of the website is the DunningKrugerTimes.com.
Beautiful.
I have to pull up this article, Matt, because it's funny enough that he, you know, just from the title of the website, you should know that it's a bullshit satire piece. But check out this website, because it's the most classic. Look, before the article, we got wrap foil around doorknobs when alone. Here's why.
Oh my God. And like, sorry, just that other one. Would you support the impeachment of Joe Biden if he opened Social Security to illegal immigrants? You know what's actually going on with benefits and illegal immigrants? They pay into the system and don't fucking pay out. That's take so out.
True. but you know, this is like a fake website. I think it's probably run by like a liberal. But when Garth Brooks took the stage at the 123rd annual Texas Country Jamboree in Hamberston, where's Hamberston, Texas? Let's see.
Hamberston, okay.
Hamberston, Texas. You know, I usually know this state. Oh, actually, it looks like that doesn't exist. So just an absolutely made up story. For 22 years, Garth Brooks has been the headliner of this event, said Toby Keith. After Brooks was booed off stage, but we really can't keep pretending he's playing.
So he's been headlining an event in Hamberston, Texas for 22 years. Yeah, in this
made up town.
And it hasn't made the news.
Toby Keith is correct, Patriots. Garth Brooks left the real country scene the day he decided to play a set in Central Park. He thought he would attract his fans from the surrounding rural areas, but instead he learned liberals just love him. And it goes on for a while.
Sorry, is that like Dylan Goes Electric when Garth Brooks played Central Park?
Also, all of these guys play big shows in you know, New York. In fact, one of the members of Montgomery Gentry, you know, famously died in a helicopter crash in New York City. I mean, this is beautiful to me. Biden owned by this video. I mean, just like all the hallmarks of an absolutely fake website.
I mean, borderline written by AI.
I think very likely written by AI. I'm sad. I guess these are all sponsored Google ads. Earlier today, there was a really good one that just had a bottle that was filled with some black sludge, and it said, "Please stop putting this in your coffee," which is like.
It is no, it's that whole like genre of local news scare stories where they're like, yeah. After the break, this household cleaner that is probably under your sink could kill all your children in the next 45 minutes. And it's like, watch after these ads.
So, Governor Abbott again losing and embarrassing himself and the state of Texas with this. Also, this piece is written by a man named Flag Eagleton Patriot. Which also
great work by that guy.
Serious, yeah. This is
future Sunday show guest.
So anyways, that's our quick Texas update, folks. We're going to go to the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Leave us a voicemail if you have anything you want to talk about at 1-940-289-7234. We will be over there in about 10-15 minutes or so. I'll be back this Thursday with a Griscom stream, and for everyone else, we'll see you soon.
See you, folks.